Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, I'll chat with the president of the Ohio Education Association about the challenges facing and goals of teachers in the new school year. And auto thefts are on the rise. Jay Fox will have advice from an expert on how to avoid becoming a victim of this crime. Plus, Doug Petcash of Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective, Ohio Education Association President Scott DeMauro. It's back to school time, and I'm sure Scott has a lot to share with us today. Thanks so much, Scott, for joining us on Columbus Perspective.
Great to be with you, Kate.
I think it's really important right now for people to remember that behind the scenes throughout the year, there are organizations like yours working to keep public education thriving here in the state of Ohio, right?
Absolutely. I'm a high school social studies teacher. This is my 34th year in education. It's always an incredibly exciting time as we're looking ahead to a new school year, new beginnings, new students, excitement about all the year has to in store for us in front of us. And also really excited about the fact that for the last several years, I've had the opportunity full time to serve as president of the Ohio Education Association. We represent nearly 120,000 educators from across the state of Ohio working in our public schools, colleges, and universities in all 88 counties. We have classroom teachers, bus drivers, school secretaries, cafeteria workers, people who are responsible for making our schools safe, clean, and conducive for student learning. And I have had the opportunity over the course of the last couple of weeks to visit a lot of our new educators as they're starting this career or starting new jobs in new districts and meet with our members around the state. And I will tell you that it is extremely exciting. This is just an awesome time of the year because we're so excited to see our kids again.
I know teachers and certainly parents are excited at this time of year. I think the jury is still out for a lot of those kids, though. They hate to see summer end.
No, it's true. Although one thing that I've learned over the years, and from I think your experience, my experience as a kid growing up, we always loved our summers. But I have really been struck by the number of students who actually they get to the end of the week or they get to a holiday break or the end of the school year, and they have a lot of apprehension because they know that maybe they don't have a reliable meal. Maybe they don't have the kind of support that they need at home that they've come to rely on at school. And, you know, it's a reminder and it's humbling for me to recognize that this isn't just about the academic success of our students. It's really providing all of our kids, including those kids who come to us from poverty, who have different kinds of learning challenges, that we are their safe space. We're the place that not only where they're going to be inspired with their creativity and imagination and desire to learn, but also where their basic needs are being met, including just having a meal in their belly so that they're fed and ready to learn.
And that is such an important point. You know, public educators specifically, I think, are on the front lines and deal with these sorts of situations that probably they never imagined would be a part of their professional life. But I know teachers who tell me about how much they have to spend out of pocket to outfit their classroom properly, or how they spend a little extra to keep snacks in their desk because they know there are certain students that aren't getting fed at home on a regular basis. And that is a challenge to them learning. It's so sad to think about. And we are so lucky to have these educators who have this level of compassion and empathy for these students who not only want to teach them the classic, you know, reading, writing, and arithmetic, as they used to say, but they're also really caring for these children. What, Scott, would you say is the best piece of advice that you can give to any parent who is about to send their child to school this fall?
Well, I think the first thing is communicate. It is so important to recognize that the teacher and the principal and the school counselor and the bus driver, all of those adults who come into contact with their children on a daily basis, share the same goal that parents have, and that I had for my two daughters as a parent. And that is, I want my kids to be safe. I want my kids to be healthy. I want my kids to learn. And you know, I want my kids to recognize that they can learn and grow and thrive and push themselves to the limits with the right kind of support. We're all in that together. And in order to make sure that we're meeting the needs of every student, open lines of communication are so critical between the school and families. Because if we don't know what maybe is going on at home, or what there's, you know, there's a special need, or some kind of challenge that a child is facing, it's harder for us to address that. And in the same way, as educators, we want to stay in open communication with parents to make sure that you know, we're sharing the good news, and some of those challenges where we need a little bit of reinforcement at home, we're all on the same page.
An analysis by the Cincinnati Inquirer newspaper found public schools outperform private schools across Ohio. And for those that maybe are looking at the difference between, do I want my kid to go to a private school or go to a public school? What do you have to say, Scott, about that analysis?
Well, I think it is very interesting. And you know, unfortunately, there's been a lot of focus and attention paid on standardized testing, which doesn't always really give the full picture of teaching and learning in the environment of a school. But it is a way that people who care about education reform have chosen to measure how we're doing. And by those measures, it is pretty startling when you see that you compare kids from the same neighborhoods, some who are going to the public schools and some who are using a voucher to attend private schools. 9 times out of 10, the kids attending the public schools are performing better. And it shouldn't come as a surprise, though, because our most highly qualified educators are working in our public schools. You know, one of the things that we do as a union, and OEA is the largest, not just teachers union, but education or union of any kind in the state, is we're advocating for the kinds of working conditions for our members that are also learning conditions for our students. So when educators are supported, when educators are respected, when educators are appropriately compensated, you're going to attract and retain good people in the profession, and that's going to lead to higher outcomes for kids. And I think that's what you're seeing in the results of that study.
Scott DeMauro is the president of the Ohio Education Association. Scott, as we embark upon a new school year, what do you see as one of the biggest challenges facing educators in Ohio?
Well, I think there's a couple things. One is, as I was just talking about, the importance of recruiting and retaining people in the profession. As I've been going around the state the last couple of weeks and meeting with new educators, I'm seeing that there are a lot of people who are new in their positions, but not necessarily new in the profession. We don't have nearly as many people choosing education as a college major coming up through the traditional ranks and entering teaching at 22 years old and choosing that as their 30 or 35 or 40 year career. And part of that is because we don't have enough resources going into fair compensation for educators, and there are some challenges when it comes to working conditions. So we have to make sure that we're very deliberate in attracting more people into the profession and making sure that our teaching profession reflects the diversity of the students we serve. Compared to our student population, which is very mixed in terms of race and gender and income level, our teaching population is much more homogeneous. And so that's one of the things that we need to work on so that every student sees someone who will connect with them in their learning. So So attracting and retaining good people in the profession, addressing issues of diversity. And then I think the other issue is that, you know, schools exist in the reality of the larger community and larger society. We know that mental health is a big issue, attending to the social and emotional needs of students, addressing just increase in anxiety and depression and other kinds of challenges. And many of those were exacerbated during the pandemic, and we still see them manifested in our schools. Means that we need resources, not just for academics, but to really attend to the needs of the whole child. And we're seeing some good progress in some places, but that's somewhat uneven. And particularly in areas where there's higher levels of poverty, we need a lot more work to make sure that our schools are fully and fairly funded so that every single kid gets the support that they need to succeed.
Is there anything else that you wanted to add before we wrap up, Scott?
Well, again, as I said at the beginning, you know, I'm going into my 34th year in education. I have not looked back once in terms of my decision. I became a teacher myself, especially a social studies educator, because I wanted to instill in my students the critical thinking, problem solving, and decision making skills that are so important to be effective citizens in our democracy. And, you know, regardless of where you are on the spectrum, we know that we are at a time in our nation's history where we need to take stock of the strength and health of our democracy. And one way to do that is to ensure that we have strong public schools. You can't have a strong democracy without having strong public schools. We're committed to strengthen our public schools, building more public support for our public schools, making sure that schools have the supports that they need to meet all kids' needs. And I'm optimistic, but we got a lot of work to do.
Scott DeMauro, president of the Ohio Education Association, I wish you a great beginning of the school year. And thank you so much for joining us today on Columbus Perspective.
Thanks, Kate. It's been my pleasure.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
A car is stolen every 32 seconds in the United States. Ohio ranks 8th in the country with almost 16,000 vehicles stolen in 2023. Columbus, Ohio is a hotbed activity with more than 10,000 cars stolen in 2023. That's more than 50% of the state's stolen cars. Almost 50% of the stolen cars were either Kias or Hyundais. July was National Vehicle Theft Prevention Month. And joining us now is George Baker, Vehicle Security Lead at General Motors. George, how are you today?
Jay, I'm doing great, and thank you very much for helping us get the word out.
Why is vehicle theft on the rise, George, or has this always been a problem?
Well, that's a good question. I think it's a number of different factors. During the pandemic, we saw some 873,000 across the nation stolen. But then in 2022, that number went up to over a million. In 2023, up to a little higher than that even. And frankly, in 24, Canada is seeing some reduction. We're seeing some stabilization here in the United States as well. But it's the rise of organized crime groups. It's the ready availability, if you will, of vehicles that can be quickly sold and then fund other activities that are criminal in nature. Lots of reasons why auto theft continues to be a problem. So this month is our opportunity to get the word out about the problem and about some techniques that can be used in order to avoid becoming a statistic.
Sure. Before we get into how we can protect ourselves here in Central Ohio, listeners want to know what happens to a vehicle after it's stolen, typically.
Well, there are a number of different things that could happen. Sometimes they're parted out, especially with the recent shortage of certain parts and components on vehicles. Other times they are re-VIN'd, or they change the identity of the vehicle by changing the vehicle identification number, and then they're sold, in some cases exported overseas, in other cases sold right here in the United States to unaware buyers who purchase often a Facebook marketplace and other means. But oftentimes, these stolen vehicles are used just to perpetrate other crimes. They're hard to trace back to an individual thief. And as such, there's a degree of anonymity, if you will, to using a stolen vehicle for homicides, bank robberies, et cetera. So there are a number of different things that could happen with your stolen vehicle.
Why is it that 50% of the stolen cars in Columbus, Ohio, were Kias or Hyundais? Are they easier to steal?
Each of us has, all of our manufacturers, if you will, have our own Achilles heel, ways that our vehicles are being stolen. And with respect to whether or not there's an immobilizer present or not, we at General Motors have had immobilizers starting with the Passkey 3 system back in 1986 with the Corvette. But in reality, Kia is doing and Hyundai are doing great things in order to reestablish trust in the brand and to make sure that their vehicles and their owners are as protected as possible. So we salute them for doing that.
Now, GM has something called the OnStar program, which it's had for a while to protect vehicles. Is that the only program of its kind, and can non-GM drivers access it, or is it just a GM feature?
Well, it is indeed a GM feature. There are other telematic systems that are provided by other manufacturers, but the OnStar system needs to be connected in order to be functional, but there are three components of it. Basically, we can provide the precise GPS location to law enforcement in order to recover a stolen vehicle as quickly as possible. We also can send a remote ignition block to prevent the thief from restarting the vehicle after it's been stolen. And lastly, we have stolen vehicle slowdown. We can send a signal to disable the accelerator. The vehicle gradually slows down, and we can avoid a potentially dangerous high-speed pursuit often associated with stolen vehicles.
Now, I'm going to show my age, but back in my day when I drove a GM vehicle, the round key was what got me in the door, and the square key was what turned on the ignition. Now we have these keyless entry features, and there's something called a wheel lock key. What is that, and why is it critical to keep it safe?
Well, wheel lock key, frankly, is the key that's assigned to your wheel locks, if you will. And the reason why we want them to be stored elsewhere from the glove compartment or the center console is because thieves, when they see your rims and tires, brand new in some cases and very expensive and easily obtained after just a couple of minutes of effort, these thieves need to basically break the window, get inside, rummage around without setting off the alarm system, rummage around the glove compartment and the center console. So if you can keep that key elsewhere, somewhere where the thieves are not going to look, then you're more likely to retain your rims and tires. So that's an important trick.
Now, I read somewhere that half of stolen vehicles are from human error. What does that refer to?
Well, it's got to do with the fact that as vehicles become more sophisticated, thieves are more oriented on getting the key to the vehicle in order to steal it. So we're now seeing thieves that are actually breaking into households just for the keys. So one human mistake that we can make, and I used to do it before I got into this job years ago, is to store or hang the keys right there on the wall out near the pedestrian door to our garage or to the front door. You don't want to do that because you want to stop the keys from being stolen by thieves. But basically, we have to treat those keys like they're an envelope stuffed full of $100 bills. And oftentimes, the spare key is left inside the vehicle permanently, if you will, with folks thinking that that's a safe thing to do, when it's the exact opposite, frankly. You don't want to allow a thief to hop in your vehicle and press ignition and then drive away because the spare key's inside. So making sure that we make smart decisions about where we park, about how we protect those keys at all times, even when we're refueling, making sure that we lock the doors and keep the keys with us so that when we get back inside the vehicle, drive away, we don't discover an assailant in the back seat with a weapon. So lots of opportunity for us to make good, smart choices as opposed to not thinking about security and then becoming a victim.
You mentioned locking your garage and making sure that your garage was part of the anti-theft process. But let's say you don't have a garage. What would be a safe place to park your car?
Well, the safest places are going to be what we traditionally have heard, which is well-illuminated, well-trafficked areas. If you're in a city, for example, an attended parking lot is always better than one that is not. And back to the garage door, unfortunately, we find a lot of folks believe that once they're parked behind a locked garage door, that they can leave the key inside the vehicle and the door is unlocked. And that's a big mistake because thieves can easily defeat most garage doors. So even in those scenarios, you got to lock the doors, make sure that all the valuables that may be visible from the outside are removed and both keys are in your possession and not inside the vehicle. So regardless of where you park, you want to play heads up ball and think about security and make sure that your vehicle is as safe as it can be.
George Baker is the vehicle security lead at General Motors. We thank you for joining us today. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV.
People are now buying marijuana for recreational use legally in Ohio. Back in November, voters approved the measure with 57% of the vote. Now, 9 months later, recreational marijuana is for sale at state-approved dispensaries. So far, 98 dispensaries across the state are open for business for recreational users. All of them had already been medicinal marijuana dispensaries. 10 of those are right here in Columbus. Customers can buy 1 ounce at a time. They need their ID to show they are 21 years old or older. To actually buy it, customers need to use cash, a debit card, or a payment app like PayPal. Credit cards are not being accepted. The booming business is expected to make the state an additional $200 million. That's because the state is tacking on an extra 10% tax on top of the sales tax. Municipalities can also add their own tax. Dispensary managers tell us they were ready for this first-of-its-kind day in Ohio.
I didn't realize, being caught in the moment of preparation, how excited we were. You know, you see this excitement in the staff.
And customers told us they were excited and curious to get inside and see what's available.
I think it's amazing. It's convenient, and I feel like the crime rate is going to go down, in my opinion.
Whatever you into, I'm pretty sure you can find it here and be safe and get educated on it, rather than getting off the streets and not know if it's safe or not. That's the only thing I can really say.
And one dispensary manager told us they're expecting a 100 to 150% increase in sales over what they had been selling in medical marijuana. 10 TV caught up with Lieutenant Governor John Husted the day recreational marijuana went on sale. He shared a couple of his concerns.
I'm concerned about it getting into the hands of children, and so we're going to continue to do everything to make sure that we make it difficult for it to be marketed to children, and we hope that people will be safe and thoughtful in how they use it.
Joining me now by Zoom from Cleveland to talk about the rollout of legal recreational marijuana is Tom Herron. He was spokesman for the Coalition to Regulate Marijuana Like Alcohol. That's the group that was behind the Issue 2 ballot initiative that voters approved last November. He is now with the Ohio Cannabis Coalition. Tom, thanks for being here this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you know, Tom, this has been a long time coming for supporters of legalized recreational marijuana. You know, what's on your mind now that sales have actually begun?
Well, quite frankly, I'm feeling an incredible amount of gratitude. You know, gratitude to the voters for trusting us at the ballot box this past November. Gratitude for the hard and thoughtful work from the regulators at the Division of Cannabis Control. And gratitude to operators here in the state of Ohio for being ready to launch the adult use program early from what was originally contemplated.
So that being said, how do you feel the introduction of this has gone so far?
I think it's gone very well. You know, it was a historic day here in Ohio, but it was also a relatively quiet day. You know, Ohio did it really well. We launched the adult use program in over 90 locations throughout the state. And that meant that you didn't have hours long wait times at these dispensaries, right? It meant that the program was really ready to launch the, you know, adult use sales in a really thoughtful and controlled manner.
How closely does your organization work with dispensaries, processors, cultivators to make sure they're following the intent and spirit of the ballot measure?
Yeah, very closely. So the Ohio Cannabis Coalition represents the majority of the cannabis industry here in Ohio. And we worked really closely, not just with operators, but also with regulators. You know, this was a hand-in-hand process. The regulators began their contemplation of new regulations and new processes for adult use sales shortly after the ballot initiative passed in November. And the staff at the division has been working tirelessly for 9 months or so to roll out this program in a way that, you know, provided quick and meaningful access to consumers so they didn't have to continue driving up to Michigan and sending their tax dollars to that state up north. They didn't have to continue purchasing products in the unregulated illicit market. And we worked really closely with them to craft those regulations and to roll out this program so that, you know, kids didn't have access, right? There are processes in place to make sure that if you want to get into a regulated dispensary, you either have to be a registered patient or you have to verify that you're over 21 years old. You know, there are rules in place about packaging and advertising to make sure that products aren't marketed to children. And the industry has really responded by self-policing in that regard as well.
Yeah, we heard Lieutenant Governor John Husted talking about one of his concerns being the marketing of these products toward children and, you know, making sure that that doesn't happen. So, you know, what is in place in terms of that? You mentioned it a little bit there to prevent that from happening.
Yeah, the best way to keep marijuana products out of the hands of kids is to regulate the sale and production of those products. Because if an operator here in Ohio sells products to somebody under 21, or they market products to somebody that's under 21, there are very stiff consequences from the Division of Cannabis Control, right? There are certain things in a regulated market that are sacrosanct. You have to ensure that products are tested. You have to ensure that the packaging is accurate so that consumers know what it is they're purchasing, whether that's from a potency standpoint, you know, to make sure that there aren't contaminants in those products. And you absolutely have to make sure that you are only selling products to somebody that's over 21 years of age, and you have processes in place at your business to prevent diversion into the illicit market. And so the best way to protect kids is to regulate the industry.
You know, one of the questions and concerns we hear is where can people smoke it or vape it or take it? You know, can they smoke it in public? I don't know. I think there's some confusion there about what's legal in that regard.
Yeah, so the statute today prevents public consumption of cannabis products. And so the way to really think about it is if you can't drink a beer somewhere, you also can't smoke a joint. If you can't smoke a cigarette somewhere, you can't smoke a joint, right? We are treating cannabis here in Ohio much in the same way that we regulate alcohol.
And, you know, another issue, of course, is what do you say to those who really worry about safety on the roads, that there will be, you know, high drivers out there who may not understand the laws about, you know, when they can get pulled over and charged with this?
Yeah, well, I've got good news in that regard, right? We've had adult use markets here in the United States throughout the country for over 10 years at this point, and the data has been very clear. There is no higher risk of impaired driving, no higher risk of traffic fatalities or traffic accidents after states decide to regulate the production of and sale of marijuana to adults. Consumers are responsible, by and large, right? They're not going to put themselves at risk by getting behind the wheel when they're impaired. And we are all aligned that people should not be driving while they're impaired, whether that's from marijuana, impaired by alcohol, or prescription drugs.
Well, the Division of Cannabis Control, you mentioned, has issued rules regulating adult use. The state legislature really has yet to agree on legislation about this. What do you want to see them do, perhaps in particular with the tax money?
Well, so under the statute, again, as it stands today, there's a 10% tax at the point of sale on every adult use product. And that's over and above your local sales tax, which in some counties can be as high as 6.5-7%. So that's an effective about 17% tax rate. And of that 10% excise tax that's special to adult use marijuana products, that revenue is already directed to go into one of several buckets. 36% of that tax revenue goes right back to the local communities where dispensaries are located with no strings attached, meaning that those communities can use that money on public parks, on fixing potholes, on, you know, buying new equipment for law enforcement or hiring more police officers, you know, really whatever the needs are in their local communities. Another 36% goes to a new social equity and jobs fund, which again uses that money to reinvest right back into local communities, particularly those communities that have been harmed over the last several decades by marijuana prohibition. The statute, for instance, is explicit that part of that money has to be used to make direct investment in those disproportionately impacted areas. Another 25% goes to a substance abuse and addiction fund, and the remaining 3% goes to fund general oversight of the program. And we've heard a lot of concerns from policymakers shortly after Issue 2 passed at the ballot box. But I think what you will see is the same thing that happened in every other state, right? The concerns that are raised are actually addressed either already in the statute or they're addressed in regulations promulgated by the Division of Cannabis Control.
We just have a little bit of time left. What do you want to see happen with this over the next few months?
Well, I think we really want to see that consumers transition away from the illicit market and start buying products in the legal, regulated market. We want to see people come back and not buy products in Michigan and bring it back to Ohio. You know, we're going to have another 100 or 130 dispensaries become operational throughout the state over the next 6 or 9 months. So you'll see access continue to improve and prices continue to drop so that we can compete more effectively with Michigan and with the illicit market.
Tom Herron with the Ohio Cannabis Coalition, thank you so much for your time joining us from Cleveland this morning. Appreciate you.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Face the State, courtesy of 10TV.
A judge made a ruling on House Bill 68. The controversial law banning transgender health care for Ohio children had been blocked since April because of a lawsuit. The Franklin County judge ruled in favor of the state allowing the law to take effect. The American Civil Liberties Union of Ohio filed the lawsuit back in March, arguing the law is unconstitutional. 10TV's Carly Dion talked to those on both sides of the issue.
We have already filed our notice of appeal. That's how strongly we feel and how confident we are.
Levinson says the ban on gender-affirming care for minors goes against the freedoms they aim to protect.
The government should not come between people and their doctor.
Despite Governor DeWine's veto of the bill in December,
I cannot sign this bill as it is currently written.
The Ohio House and Senate enacted the bill into law in January. It was set to go into effect 90 days later. But in March, the ACLU of Ohio filed a lawsuit claiming the bill was unconstitutional. In April, the Franklin County Court of Common Pleas issued a temporary restraining order blocking the bill from going into effect.
It's care that has proven to be safe, effective, and oftentimes life-saving.
Over the last few weeks, the lawsuit was tried in court. The ACLU claiming House Bill 68, or the Save Adolescents from Experimentation Act, violates four separate clauses of the Ohio Constitution. But a 13-page decision from Judge Holbrook states it does not violate any of those clauses, banning gender-affirming care for minors and preventing transgender student-athletes from participating in women's sports, effective immediately.
This is a big deal that this law was passed and now has been upheld.
Center for Christian Virtue President Aaron Baer says this fight is about protecting kids.
It's dangerous to put kids on puberty-blocking drugs that can sterilize them for life or put them on wrong sex hormones. These procedures should not be done on children. And we presented so much evidence from medical experts and other leading experts to show that this should not be done.
But families like Evangelical Lutheran Church in America deacon Nick Bates feel differently. As the father of a gender non-binary high school freshman, he says this bill is about allowing kids to be who they are and to feel accepted.
Being a parent is hard enough. Being a teenager is hard enough. And it only makes it more difficult when you have your government telling you that you don't belong.
That was Carly Dion reporting. A day after the ruling, we heard directly from Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost. He says the law protects children.
You're still growing up, and irrevocable decisions are not a good idea. The state's got a right, I think, to protect the children of this state, and the court agreed.
Parties on both sides say they will continue to fight for what they believe in. Again, the ACLU of Ohio says they plan to appeal the judge's decision. Attorney General Yost also announced a first-ever statewide hotline to help those struggling with human trafficking. It's set to be activated next month. Yost made the announcement at the 5th Annual Human Trafficking Summit. The hotline number will be 844-END-OHHT. That stands for End Ohio Human Trafficking. The goal is to get tips about suspected sex and labor trafficking straight to Ohio law enforcement. Yost says there are situations people get into where they aren't sure how to get help.
See people who are brought here under false pretenses and then forced to work in restaurants, to work in agriculture, sometimes in building trades. And, of course, we have had a couple of actions here in Ohio, a couple of investigations involving massage parlors. So there's a lot to be done there.
The attorney general says his hope is that hotline will go live after Labor Day. And now to the race for the White House. Vice President and Democratic nominee for President Kamala Harris chose Minnesota Governor Tim Walz as her running mate. Ohio Democratic and Republican leaders are weighing in on that decision. Democrats call Walz a successful and effective leader, a good communicator, and a genuine person. Republicans call him radical, left-wing, and extreme.
Very pleased with the pick today.
We're excited, very happy.
Ohio House and Senate Minority Leaders Allison Russo and Nikki Antonio are pleased, excited, and happy because they say Governor Walz has shown himself to be a successful governor who will resonate with voters across the country. They also believe he will be a good partner with Vice President Kamala Harris.
I think that Walz has shown himself to be an effective communicator of those values around freedom, opportunity, dignity. He's done that very effectively.
I think his strength, frankly, is that he's been successful in his state and can bring that to the discussion as they move across the country and talk to folks in those battleground states.
Democratic strategist Dale Butland says Walz will have a lot of cachet in the battleground Midwestern states and Pennsylvania and has a background people can relate to.
He comes from a small town. He's a teacher, a football coach, with a military background, with a folksy manner. And most importantly of all, he comes across as thoroughly normal and absolutely genuine, which is a marked contrast with Donald Trump's pick.
Republican Lieutenant Governor John Husted says Harris's choice of Walz surprised him.
I thought she would attempt to signal moderation by picking Josh Shapiro out of Pennsylvania, but instead she doubled down on picking a really radical left-wing governor.
In a statement, Ohio Republican Party Chairman Alex Triantafilou said about Walz, in part referring to the riots after George Floyd's murder, he failed to protect his citizens from the most violent and dangerous riots in recent memory. He went on to say, just like Sherrod Brown, he has been and will continue to be a rubber stamp for Kamala Harris and Joe Biden's radical agenda that has crushed Ohio's middle-class families.
I don't know how one can be too progressive if progressive means, you know, feeding kids, women having the right to make their own decisions about personal, private, reproductive rights and everything else.
Democrats believe Harris has reinvigorated the party and Walz will add to that and help bring in undecided voters.
Certainly, I can confirm there is a lot of enthusiasm on the ground. I mean, we've seen people showing up, volunteering for campaigns, getting out to knock on doors over the last 2 weeks.
Ohio Senator and Republican vice presidential nominee J.D. Vance had this to say about Governor Walz being Harris's choice for running mate.
This is a guy who's proposed shipping more manufacturing jobs to China, who wants to make the American people more reliant on garbage energy instead of good American energy, and has proposed defunding the police just as Kamala Harris does.
With Trump choosing Vance as his running mate, President Biden stepping aside for Kamala Harris, and now Harris picking Walz as her running mate, Americans have had a lot to keep up on politically. All of that happened in a relatively short time frame. So we hit the street to hear what people think about the way the race is shaping up.
Those for Harris.
But I think it's a good choice. I think she's qualified, and I think she is ready to do the job.
And those for Trump.
And I just really think that we need Trump back in there.
Others intrigued by the history of Biden stepping aside.
I think it's very interesting because you never seen it before. You never seen it happen.
And the possibility of more history.
I think that the president should be a woman. I mean, no offense, but I think a lady knows what they're doing.
Most of those we talked to on camera say recent developments have energized them about the race, whether it's Harris now at the top of the ticket or J.D. Vance as Trump's running mate.
Again, that's Doug Petcash, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV. From the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. Heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM ESPN Columbus.